This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Today, Jeanette Remack returns to talk to us about the XB70, the Valkyrie. Jeanette, of course, was our guest recently when we talked about the space shuttles, and I read out Jeanette's bio then. So welcome back, Jeanette.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Yeah, glad to hear your voices a little better.
Yes, it is.
Now, we're also joined by Jeanette's co-author on the book XB70 Valkyrie, The Return to Valhalla, Joe Ventolo Jr. Joe is an author, radio presenter, and aviation historian. After service in both the US Air Force and Air Force Reserve, Joe progressed through his career in broadcasting, journalism, and aviation history to become the curator of the US Air Force Museum in 1993. He was also named curator of the United States Air Force. Currently, Joe is co-owner with Jeanette for Phoenix Aviation Research. Joe, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to join you.
We're very honoured to have both Jeanette and Joe with us. I believe you've been together now for about 25 years with Phoenix Aviation Research.
That's right.
Wow. Now, we're going to talk about an aircraft that's iconic in looks, if nothing else, and of course, summarised in two of your books, but we're going to focus on The Return to Valhalla. Let's talk about the XB70 and where it all started, Jeanette. What were the background to the requirements for the aircraft?
Well, the background to the requirements actually goes back to Curtis LeMay, General Curtis LeMay. As you know, LeMay was head of SAC at that time, and what he did is he actually sent off a secret letter to the Pentagon outlining what he felt was going to be the next intercontinental bomber that was going to replace the B-52, which is still flying, God, 60 years. He wanted something that was going to have a 600-mile-an-hour cruise speed, a 1,000-mile-an-hour supersonic dash, you know, all the rest. He just did not want to have a situation where he would have to land on foreign soil to be refueled or aerial refueling.
Right.
So he was looking for the Big Apple is what he was looking for. And what he was looking for and what he got were almost two different things. You know, you got to look at the fact that we had the Truman administration in there, and the Truman administration was just coming out. Eisenhower was just coming in. Eisenhower had a pent-up hate for the military-industrial complex, where Truman was giving the services anything they wanted. You know, Eisenhower wasn't up to that. He felt that they should not be getting everything they want, and he was really tightening the purse strings on them. So a lot of people also felt that Eisenhower was a farm boy and that he really didn't understand the nature of the, quote, military-industrial complex. So it was a lot of give and take there, a lot of fighting back and forth. The B-70 design came in. Boeing and North American Aviation put the proposal together. They had about 6 months to come up with it, which really wasn't a lot of time. They had it's almost science fiction. When you think about it, the stuff that they came up with was so futuristic, and it was also coming in at 1 million pounds weight. It was like, it's not going to happen. It just isn't going to happen. So
we'd never seen anything like that, had we, at this time?
We had never seen anything like this, anything.
And this is back in the
50s, back in
the 50s.
The late 50s, like 54, 57. And
right.
So when you think about it, though, I mean, you know, a 1,000-pound airplane, you know, you're not going to get that off the runway in a 2-minute scramble. I mean, that just wasn't going to happen. So they had to go back and they had to rework that whole theory and take a look at, again. It was a bloody battle between the Oval Office and Congress, you know, for months. In 1960, in July, Congress gave $75 million additional spending for the B-70, quote, program. And Eisenhower basically did that only to shut everybody up. He knew he was going out of office. He couldn't – while he canceled the – so much fighting going on, he just couldn't totally cancel the program. So he put the extra $75 million in there, hoping to appease everybody until the new president, JFK, came in and drop it in his lap. And that's precisely what he did. And the problem there was, though, here you go. You got JFK. He comes in with his henchman, Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense. It was a new administration. It was a young administration. It was a different view to things.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, the other things going on in the background, what a lot of people don't know, and this is something that's really put out in the book a little bit more than I'm going to talk about, but there was a situation where JFK was being briefed on the A-12 Blackbird, and McNamara was there. And LeMay was there, and Kelly Johnson was there from Lockheed. And
Jeanette, just one thing. Just sorry to interrupt you there. There was a previous relationship between McNamara and LeMay, wasn't there?
Yes, now, there
LeMay was.
LeMay was
seen as a strategist, a great performer in the Second World War. He was well respected in military circles. But, and there is a but, McNamara and he crossed paths, haven't they,
actually,
in the services?
He was McNamara's boss in the statistical divisions during World War II.
Right.
And him and McNamara never really got along. He never, you know, McNamara was now in the high seat, and LeMay was sort of begging. So, and believe me, McNamara never forgot it. He really did a job on him.
Yeah, so I just wanted to get that in, to put it into context.
Absolutely.
Because there was personal differences in the mix as well as technical ones.
Absolutely. So here we go, and JFK is being briefed, and he's being briefed about the A-12, and he turned around to Kelly Johnson, and he said, listen, he said, can this A-12 be turned into a bomber? So Kelly thought for a minute, and he said, well, yeah. He says it could be turned into a bomber, and here come the fatal words. Well, then what do we need the XB-70 for? Well, LeMay almost dropped it right there. But, in fact, that's how we got the 12 Interceptor, which the Air Force, you know, only really tested. They never really bought it. So I just want to leave a little section there that there was that issue going on.
Right,
of course,
okay.
Senator Carl Vinson, who was a Democrat from Georgia, was really the proponent for the A-12, for the Valkyrie. He was fighting for her. He really wanted to get her on the boards, okay? So it was push came to shove. Vinson and McNamara got together, and McNamara said, look, I'm not backing this program. Get it. I'm giving you the $75 million. You know, that's it. You get 3 test vehicles. Forget about the $250 for production. You get 3 test vehicles. That's all you get. Well, you know, what could Vinson do? I mean, you know, he had to sign off on it. He lost the 250 aircraft. But again, what McNamara had in his mind is, you know, McNamara was also a proponent of MAD, and what MAD is mutually assured destruction. And what that means is I'm going to send a missile over there that's going to blow you to hell, and you're going to send one over here that's going to blow me to hell, and that's going to be the end of the war. Over. And he really subscribed to this theory. He was hot for it. So he was more into ICBMs than he was ever thinking about bombers.
Yeah.
And
whereas,
of course, you know,
and this is
you
where,
can't recall an ICBM.
No, but this was where LeMay and he disagreed.
Really differed,
because LeMay had a much more strategic view of warfare, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
And that's where the XB-70 fitted in. And, of course, as you mentioned there, the B-52 was already on the drawing boards, and this was designed to actually replace it, wasn't
it? Yes, she was designed to be the replacement.
Right, okay. Well, let's go on then to talk about the development of the aircraft and who went on to design and manufacture those 3 test vehicles. Because they got the money and they started the program, and this was as you say, late 50s, early 60s. Mm-hmm. Who was awarded the contract?
Well, basically what happened was in the fall of 1954, the Air Force came out with GOR 38, which is a general order requirement. And what they had in there was for a long-range piloted bomber to replace the B-52. Air Force gave out letters to both Boeing and North American for phase one of this new program, which was going to be WS-110A/L, if you're willing to be technical, for the development. And that was for three research vehicles. So Boeing and North American came up, and basically what it came down to was North American got the ball, okay?
Right.
Boeing wasn't happy about that, but, you know. So North American came in, and there was a gentleman by the name of Harrison Storms. And he may sound familiar to a lot of people because Harrison Storms was also one of the directors for the Apollo program working for NASA through North American. Harrison was a genius, and he was a loose cannon too. And Harrison was the one that really saw the XB-70 in his mental eye. He is responsible for kind of forming her and saying, "Okay, guys, this is what we're going to do." He was also working on the basis of the there was a paper that was out on compression lift, and this paper goes back to NACA. This goes way back to the 1940s by a guy by the name of Syverson and Eggers. And these two gentlemen wrote this paper on compression lift. And this gave Stormy, which was his nickname, a very good idea. He said, "Well, yeah, use compression lift. This will be awesome." So when they started to really design the XB-70, they really started designing based on that. And they were looking, of course, for a bomber that was going to go with a range of 4,000 nautical miles, allowing for aerial refueling to bring it up to 5,500 miles if necessary. She's going to have to carry nuclear weapons, be able to fly 60,000 feet with a supersonic dash. Now, here comes the Air Force again. You know, never happy, as Joe knows. They came in and they said, "No, we want 70 to 75,000 feet. We want the range increased to 5,500 to 6,000, maybe even 11,000 miles. And this was all supposed to be done by December of 57. It's like, yeah, okay. Yeah. Let's go to work, guys. You know, so this is what they did. So
one thing I have to point out, while all this is going on, the XB-70 was in no way a top secret program as far as the public was concerned.
Right, okay.
This played out in the news, the national news, and particularly where I worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, because all of the contracts, development contracts, and the regular procurement contracts were handled right there at the headquarters of the what became the Air Force Logistics Command. And I was working at a small organization called the Air Force Motion Picture Film Repository, the Air Force's Film Archives.
Yeah.
And we followed this. As soon as the film came in, we followed this very closely. But it was covered in the media day by day by day, particularly in our area.
Yeah. And that is, of course, as Jeanette mentioned, as opposed to the A-12.
Which was so black, it was ridiculous. Yeah.
So yes, there were games being played on both sides of the of the table. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. The A-12 wasn't really known about until many years later, after it was retired.
Right, okay. So the goalposts were moved. I think they added Mark III as well to the requirements.
Yes, they did. It's like throw everything in there. Why not?
Which is quite something. Then let's talk about how this aircraft was actually designed and some of the technical aspects of how it was put together, because it was the most complex aircraft at that time. We've got to remember where we were. Man had only just got to space, but here we were talking about an aircraft that was going to do something three times greater than anything that had ever existed before. You talked about some of the flight principles there. Obviously, the XB-70 looks unique. It's an iconic look. I think you described it as a cobra waiting to strike. I don't think there's a better description of that.
Actually, there is a better description.
Is there? Oh yeah, we talked about that on the last show, didn't we? Do you want to just remind us?
Well, yeah, there. Joe, maybe you want to tell the Jesus Christ.
Oh, you want to hear that? There was a legend going around. By the time that the airplane and its mock-up was ready to be seen, this was opened up to some of the national press and, of course, the industry representatives. This was in a building, and they had it displayed in a rather dramatic way. This is not a small airplane and is not a common shape for an airplane. And the story was that whenever they opened the door and these people walked in, the first thing you heard was somebody say, "Jesus Christ." Well, and that repeated itself every time it happened. So the airplane at that point became known as the Savior.
Right.
Among the press. And Jeanette, I don't know if you want to... I don't know if you want to introduce
let's describe the aircraft so that people can understand the size and the complexity.
She is 189 feet long.
Most of the structure in the wings and fuselage is of stainless steel. These are our now famous honeycomb core sandwich panels, and many of the outer skins on these honeycomb panels are as thin as 7/1000ths of an inch. The two-man crew will sit side by side. The crew station in this position is about 20 feet above the ground. All of the space aft of the crew compartment is taken up by fuel, both in the fuselage and in the wings.
She is three stories off the ground, okay, with gear extended, okay? It has a wingspan of 105 feet. She weighs empty 253,000 pounds. When she's loaded, she's over 530,000 pounds. Her maximum takeoff weight is 542,000 pounds. She's got a six-pack, which was an innovation of the YJ-93 engines, which were made by General Electric. No other aircraft in the world ever used these engines again or ever did before. They were made specifically for her. And I'll get into some of the fine-tuning of that. That six-pack that you have in the back is the first time that has ever been done anywhere.
We'll come to the engines in a while.
A little later, yes.
I just want to talk about the configuration of the aircraft. She was a delta-winged aircraft, but she had canards as well.
She's delta-wing, which is the arrow shape. She does have canards that have movable flaps, which is just, if you look at where the cockpit is, it's a little bit just barely behind the cockpit. Okay, and they do extend. They are out at all times. They do not retract. Her wingtips,
right, and they were to help with the speed at which she landed as well. Because she landed at very high speeds, didn't she?
She landed at extremely high speeds. She could do a 6,500 foot runway in 45 seconds to dead stop.
Right. Okay.
That's pretty good in my book.
Okay.
So, she was huge. She is huge. There's no way that a photograph actually describes her. I mean, you can look at it and you can say, wow, yeah, big airplane. But until you walk in there and you actually stand in front of her, there's no way for you to really comprehend just how gorgeous and magnificent she is. And the fact that she did take off.
Jeanette.
I'm sorry?
You were a prime example of surprise.
Yeah, I mean, I walked in there and just fell out. I mean, I had the blessing of being allowed to go up into the XB-7. I've taken some pictures and stuff and explore the inside, the cockpit, all the way back to where the flash tanks were, to where the first fuel tank was.
Right.
You're
and
welcome,
I have
Jeanette.
I'm sorry?
I said, you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Joe was the one responsible for that. And it was absolutely one of the most amazing experiences I think I've ever had in aviation. It's number one on the hit parade.
Right. Okay.
It really is.
Let me test you a little bit more about the aircraft a little bit in terms of some of the specs. One of the things that I picked up from the book is she was designed to be operated in quote unquote a shirt sleeve environment by the crew. But also, and dare I say it, I know we spent a lot of time talking about metallurgy when we were talking
about the
shuttles. But of course, the speeds she was designed or expected to fly at required her to have a very particular structure and skin covering as well, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, the skin was amazing. It actually was an innovation. Nobody had ever done that either. And North American Aviation was responsible for coming up with the technology for it. She used what is known as a stainless steel honeycomb panel. And what that did is that also allowed for the weight of the airplane to be not so heavy. If it wasn't for the honeycomb panels, they would have really been in trouble, okay? She used something like that. They're 10 by 20 feet, if you can imagine, for one aircraft. There's 45 panels for one aircraft. They are actually, you have a stainless steel panel on top. I'm simplifying this, okay? And that steel fabrication is made of Rene 41, which was a new material of that time, plus 8% titanium. There was internal, how do I explain this? Like a razor thin ribbons. And there was a special gear mechanism that created these razor thin ribbons of steel, crinkled steel. And these were about a half an inch thick. And what they would do is they would crinkle these rolls. They would lay them out on the panel. They would put the other panel down and they would use a high solder temperature to seal everything together. It almost had a science fiction look to it because it was very dark. It was shiny. It was milled to perfection.
Right.
And it was smooth. But again, it was very touchy. A fingerprint could cause the brazing of these panels not to take. It had to be literally done in NASA white rooms, if you know what I mean by a NASA white room. Completely, you know,
clean.
Yeah, the whole bit.
Clean.
Between the two panels were these honeycombs. A honeycomb is roughly equivalent to what you see in a cardboard box with the two layers on the outside.
Yeah.
But these were much thicker, and that's where these steel ribbons were composed to make this honeycomb. And it was a grand insulation type of thing. For one thing, it was a great strengthener.
And there were some really innovative ideas built into this aircraft. And again, we've got to look back to where we were, you know, late 50s, early 60s. The cockpit was a complete unit, wasn't it? It was designed
to literally work in, quote, shirt sleeve environment, although that when they flew, they did fly in pressure suits because it was still a test program.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and things like the landing gear and mm-hmm. disc brakes and things like that. These were the innovations that this aircraft was bringing to the world.
Absolutely. The fact that, you know, she had over 22,000 parts made of titanium, and that was just in the forward fuselage. She had another 12,000 parts that were made, you know, and the fact that the titanium was being mixed into the canard box and into the flaps and into the vertical stabilizers along with this honeycomb panel, I mean, that was amazing stuff. And then, of course, you had the splitter, which was the magic to the whole thing. When you come underneath the wing, you have two huge ducts that are under there, okay, that lead to the engines. Now, these guys are 80 feet long. When you start out with them, like if I don't know how tall you are, but a 6 foot tall guy could literally stand in that duct. But as he walked back the 80 feet, it would get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it reached the engine where it would fit directly into the engine. Okay?
Well, let's talk about those then, Jeanette. You described them as the six-pack, and anyone who now has a picture or goes and looks at a picture will know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, the engines go straight across.
There were all sorts of challenges. Those air intakes, as you said, ran down into the into the packs of three. As we know, that created all sorts of challenges because of the speed of the air that went in. But let's talk about the engine design. Let's talk about these innovative engines that were going to power this aircraft to Mach 2.5, maybe Mach 3.
Okay. The YJ-93 was built by General Electric Aircraft. As I said before, the engine made specifically for this aircraft were never used on any other aircraft ever again. They carried 18,000 pounds of thrust each, which if you do that times six comes up to 108,000 pounds of thrust. That's what brought her up to her Mach 3 speed.
Yeah.
And she was also a huge airframe to, you know, go on with it. The engines also had something that a lot of engines did not have, and that was gold plating. The gold plating was done on some of the plumbing lines, but most especially in the shroud on the afterburner, and that was to help with the heat dispersion. The blades were an innovation. They had what they called stem drilling. These huge turbine blades, okay, were electrolytically drilled with air cooling holes that helped them to make the engine work a little bit better. You know, it also kept them cooler because of the tremendous heat that was going on there. The engines were also interchangeable. As anyone knows, if you have like an F-15, okay, you have X amount of engines and an F-15, okay, you take one engine out, you can't necessarily swap that same engine over to the other side, okay? It's more like a left-right thing, okay? With the XB-70, you could literally take one engine and put it anywhere in the six-pack. It didn't matter. If they had a change in engine, woof, one engine, 25 minutes. Where with the B-52, just to give you an example, it would take four men an hour and a half.
Right.
So if you're on the flight line and you got to get this bird going and you need to get her out of here, okay, in, out, slam, we're done, goodbye.
Mm.
Can I add something about the engines, Jeanette?
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Those engines grew in power to become 30,000 pounds thrust each, up to 180,000 pounds by the time that airplane would have been
gone in the third Valkyrie.
And
that narrowing intake. You described it perfectly because that was the way at high speeds you reached compression of the intake air to feed the face of those engines. That was a design for that, and
That was also all variable geometry because that's how it was controlled.
Yeah.
The panels were controlled that way.
Right. So the engineering, so as the air sped up, because of course the air was much slower in the intake at low speeds than it was at high altitude, high speeds, the engines were sucking at different pressures. And so the air intakes were adjusted to do that. It was really, really innovative, but they did have challenges with that, didn't they?
They usually called duck buzzes or unstarts. Unstart's a familiar word to anybody that knows the SR-71. And really what that is that the air going in doesn't go in quite correctly or goes in too fast, too slow, whatever, and it gets kicked back out. And that causes one hell of a shakeup in the airplane. So the co-pilot would be like, really, they were going at Mach speed. That co-pilot just didn't sit back and look pretty. He had to work, okay, because this was his thing. He had to control that. But an unstart could be a real nasty deal. So they were really in the first airplane. They did not have AICS, which was automatic intake control. The second aircraft had it, where it was automatically done. On the first aircraft, AV-1, 20,001, it had to be done by hand. So the co-pilot had to really be on top of everything to make sure that they were measured correctly.
Yeah. Now, to feed those monstrous beasts, all six of them, two things had to be developed. Obviously, a unique fuel had to be developed, but also the way the fuel was carried and used in the aircraft as itself. So it was something called zip fuel was developed, wasn't it?
Well, zip fuel was starting to be developed. Actually, what the XB-70 used was called JP-6, and this was a low flashpoint fuel, which means it was extremely volatile. And what would happen, like during loading, it would actually work like this. You would have one tank that would feed in, okay? It would actually go to another tank. When the second tank was started to get loaded, they would start dribbling in liquid nitrogen. And this was done to inert the fuel to make it a little more safe, and then it would go into the aircraft, okay? So they were inerting the fuel already to make sure that by the time it hit the airplane, it was going to be safe enough, okay? Because it was really treacherous stuff. As to the zip fuel, or what they call HEF, or high energy fuel, there was some money that was put into it. The Navy tried to come up with Project ZIP, Z-I-P as in Peter, and that was done by the Callery and Olin Matheson Chemical Company. They got together some alkylated borane and some ethyl decarbamine mix, and they were trying to make it into almost like a slushy I don't know if you have them there, but over here at 7-Eleven, we have slushies. And what it is, it's like an ice with juice on it, you know, that kind of thing. It looks something like that, actually. And the Air Force jumped in, and they put in a small-scale project called DASH. And that led to the first extrapolated small-scale lab version of a J-79 afterburner that they could test it on. Okay, so they were doing that. But there were a lot of problems with temperature bearings, coatings, how to minimize spontaneous ignition, which was a very dangerous situation. Fuel storage was another problem. It was very expensive to fuel the stuff. How were they going to move it? Because it was 10 times more, if you looked at it, it was 10 times worse than the worst cyanide.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
corrosive.
It was really, extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
So they were looking for ways and measures of doing this. And basically, by 1957, they just called it a halt because it just wasn't going anywhere. It was just too expensive for the time period. So what they did stay with was the JP-6 and, of course, inerting it, and, using it that way. But it's actually – it's been brought up to speed a little bit more today. There are people working on slurry fuel now.
Right. Okay.
They're just not talking a lot about it, but they're doing it on kind of a private thing. But they are talking about doing this again. So.
Well, the XB-70 also used the fuel in another way, and although again we're familiar with this now, it was innovative then. Yeah, exactly. It was used to dissipate some of the heat from the aircraft, wasn't it? Because she got very hot, and her engines made her hotter as well.
Even hotter as well. Yeah. Actually, the skin on XB-70, when she got up to Mach 2.7, Mach 3, would be about 550 degrees. And that's pretty hot.
Yeah.
And her tank temperatures were about 100 degrees. Her fuel tank temperature is about 100 degrees. So what would happen is the heat sink would dissipate some of this. She also had flash tanks on board. There were water flash tanks and ammonia flash tanks that would help to dissipate some of that heat also. So it was a two-way street. It was the fuel was helping to do it, and the flash tanks were also helping to do it. The flash tanks were actually like a backup system for it.
Yeah, yeah. But they were not insignificant. I mean, about 4,000 gallons.
By no means. Yeah. When I actually saw them, because I did see the water tanks in the aircraft, I saw them. I was like, what? I was like, are you kidding me? Yeah, it was unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. I wish we were able to show photographs of what we're talking about because it's so amazing. But in the inside, if you go inside the book, there are tons of photographs. So you could get a better idea.
Jeanette crawled around that airplane cockpit, and she was in behind one of the tanks just checking it out. And you should have seen the grin on her face, boy.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, listen, let's keep that grin on for a while. We're going to take a little break now, and we're going to come back, talk about defensive armaments, how she progressed in her development, and most amazingly, a story from Joe, because you saw it fly. So we'll be back shortly.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the Society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Well, we've still got the smile on our face from Jeanette's trip into the cockpit and crawling through the water and fuel tanks of the XB-70. But let's talk now about how she defended herself. It was all about speed, of course, but she was a bomber.
Yeah, she was a bomber, but she did need to have some kind of defense. That's what they were looking at. Actually, they came up with, what would be the first lenticular missile. Which would actually, the only way to describe it would be a little flying saucer, okay? Well, I wouldn't say little, but a flying saucer, okay? And that was the first time. That was being developed by the Wright Air Development Center over at Wright-Patterson, where Joe was hanging out. It was very unorthodox. The other thing they were thinking about was the GAR-9 or the AIM-47 missile, which was also used with the YF-12. Everyone knows that the YF-12 is an interceptor. They used the AIM-47/GAR-9 Falcon missile for the YF-12 also. But they were going to have to do some modification on that GAR-9 in order for her to use it. And that would have actually come out in the third Valkyrie. Okay. These two airplanes were just R&D. That was it. They had no defensive platforms underneath. They had nothing like that built in. So that was going to come out in the third Valkyrie. But the other thing she was going to have was her little sister, the F-108 Rapier.
Right, yeah.
And she was an interceptor. She was going to be literally a baby clone of the B-70. She was going to go for Mach 3 dash if they could get it. She was going to use the YJ-93. She was going to be just about everything you could want for the B-70 as a protection. Unfortunately, they never even built one, which I'm very sorry for. I have photographs of the mock-up. It breaks my heart that they didn't build at least one airplane because it would have been stunning. It would have been absolutely stunning. And just the thought of it. Actually, if you look at the A-5 Vigilante, which is also made by North American, she kind of would almost look like a big sister to what the Rapier would have been. So you could get an idea almost what the Rapier would have looked like, except that the A-5 is much, she's got a longer nose. She was made for the Navy. She's a Mach 2. She's the only Mach 2 airplane that ever went off a carrier deck. So you could see that some of the things that would have been incorporated into the F-108 went into the A-5 Vigilante.
Right. Jeanette, sorry, one thing we didn't cover earlier, I forgot to ask you about, mm-hmm. was her, we said she's a bomber. We didn't actually say what she was designed to carry. She was designed to carry both.
She was designed to carry nuclear weapons.
But was she also designed to carry conventional weapons? Or was it purely nuclear?
That wasn't the prime design. She could have, as all bombers could have, but she was designed to carry thermonuclear weapons.
Right.
Yeah, thermonuclear weapons.
Right, okay.
She was going to take the heavy, hot stuff.
Yeah. But as you said, the defensive systems never got onto the first the first couple of aircraft. So let's talk then about what happened to the XB-70, because in that design program and in that testing program, something happened that really cast a spell over its future, regardless of McNamara's intentions. And that, of course, was, as you quoted, the death of the Queen.
Yeah, I wrote that chapter and I literally cried through it. Yeah. It was one of the most painful things I've ever written, I have to tell you. I read it and I read every inch of the reports and reread every inch of the reports that came out. You know, it's too easy to just simplify it and say Joe Walker, who was the test pilot with the F-104, flew into the B-70. It's too easy to simplify it that way. Mm. And there are a couple of things that I know I want to make clear here. First, Joe Walker was the chief test pilot for NASA. He was a consummate test pilot. He had over 5,000 hours. He flew next to the B. He was going to fly the B-70 next after this quote promotional flight. The next flight was going to be his.
So Jeanette, to come back to go forward. For those who don't know, the XB-70 was on a promotional flight in June 1966.
Yes,
And she was being accompanied by both chase planes and aircraft photographing her. And as we said earlier, this was very much in the public domain. There was a lot of focus on it, so there was a lot of desire to have photography and film of the aircraft. And sadly, that F-104 came into contact with the XB-70, didn't it?
Right. But you see, it was something that was done today. It wasn't technically maybe legal, quote, legal, but this was something that was done every day. There were plenty of other contracts that asked for flights for their specific aircraft or whatever. So when GE requested this flight, they went through the motions. They went through the proper channels. Okay, it's not that they didn't; they did, but it was kind of somebody kind of dropped the ball on the Air Force end of it. That's the only way I can put it. Where I don't know if Joe's going to agree with that or not, but that's pretty much how I saw it. And you know, unfortunately, she had a B-58, she had the F-104, she had the F-5. What else did she have with her?
Was there a Learjet, or some sort of?
Was not in the formation. The Learjet was behind and doing the photography. Yeah, she was outside the formation.
Right.
Yeah, point out too that during the testing, this formation flying was not unusual. It had been done again and again and again.
So what happened, Joe? What caused this? I mean, but you both come to some conclusions in there. But what's the belief then as to why this happened?
And I think one of the conclusions was that somehow Joe Walker in the F-104 got a little too close to the down drooped right wing of the XB-70.
Wingtip.
And contacted the wingtip and then rolled left over the verticals.
Which
he died. He died immediately. And it took off both of the verticals, and then the 104 fell in a ball of fire aft. The XB-70 remained stable for about 15 seconds, to the point where the director for that formation, Joe Cotton, said, "You got it. It's stable. Don't do anything." Basically, he was saying, "Don't do anything strange. We might get you out of there." And about that time, she went inverted into an inverted
She went vertical, and then she went into a flat spin. And that was it.
And into the ground. Right. That was a number shift, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes, that was 20207, which was actually was the more technically evolved aircraft.
Yeah.
But the shame of it was is that actually I don't believe that on the XB-70, when you see her with her wingtips down, okay, that creates such a vortex of air that when the F-104, now there was another pilot by the name of John Fritz. He was flying the F-5 and he was a little bit behind Joe Cotton. He said that he had seen Joe's airplane move a little bit, side to side, fore and aft, up and down, but nothing that was drastic. And basically what happened is Joe got sucked into this vortex, slammed into the wingtip, then she just rolled over, hit the verticals, and it was all over. But did Joe purposely hit that? No.
No, the vortex
Walker, sucked him into it.
Walker was a skilled test pilot. He had no fault in this. It was just one of those bad things that happened.
But there were a lot of people that felt that Chuck Yeager, for one, in his autobiography, basically felt that Joe Walker should not have been up there flying any kind of formation because he was out of tune with it. He shouldn't have been up there doing it. And that's in his book that he wrote with Leo Janis. There's a quote in there on it, which I have to tell you, we took him to task in the book because that just doesn't buy. Number one, you don't do that to a brother pilot. Second thing is, you know, Yeager, I know how many fans you might have out there for Chuck Yeager, but, you know, there are things you say, there are things you don't say, okay?
Well, he's a tough West Virginian.
Exactly, but, and, you know, he's not the best loved.
No, a lot of people are not best loved when they're in this business.
That's for sure, I know.
And not to be too contentious about it, but there was an investigation.
Yes,
it was over and done with. Very, very quickly. Ultimately, I think that, you know, sadly was the nail in the coffin, but no one came up.
The nail was in the coffin before that. This just helped McNamara bang it in. Let's put it that way.
Jumping on then, let's talk a little bit about flying the XB-70. Of course, you know, none of us did, but it wasn't an easy aircraft to fly, was it?
She had her issues.
No autopilot.
Here we go with the gear on the count. 3, 2, 1, gear.
No autopilot, you know, designed to fly at Mach 3 at 70,000 feet. That's just a bit of a challenge to fly, and we certainly have spoken to people on the show who've flown some challenging aircraft. So we were talking about these pilots being the best of the best, weren't we?
Yeah, and they were. Yeah. They were.
And there is... It doesn't sound like it, but we have a couple of recordings from the internal system of the XB-70, particularly during the first flight with Al White and Joe Cotton in the co-pilot seat, and we have all of the conversation that was going on. And when you listen to it, it sounds like, well, okay, do this, okay, fine, do that. And then, well, okay, now we're landing. And, by the way, your landing gear is on fire. Roger, we don't feel up here. But we have maybe a couple of in-flight audio recordings that are just fascinating in that you can sense that it's a very complex airplane and they're working very hard. But they're pilots,
yeah,
and they don't talk like it. They're yes, do this fine.
It was very calm, wasn't it?
We'll take care of that.
Well, there was Paperclip. I mean, Paperclip was perfect.
Paperclip, yeah.
Paperclip. They had a problem. The gear wouldn't come down. I think it was Al White got up and he looked around. He says, "Oh, hey, tools." He said, "But I do have a Paperclip." He went back to the bus board, which was a vertical bus board that had must have been like 100 different fuses on there. Okay,
that was Cotton that did that, by the way.
Oh, Cotton did it, right? Yeah. He went back there with the paperclip. He kind of jiggled it in there, and the next thing you know, oh gee, the gear came down.
Yeah.
There it goes.
And there was a comment in the book as well that you said if the gear should fail, the only recourse would be to bail out.
Yeah.
But on the first landing. The gear, the right mains locked up.
The brake just locked up. And
the brakes locked up, everything locked up, and they ground them down, you know, several several inches or about 6 inches.
He came in with a hot foot.
And the pilots way up front in that bouncing nose didn't notice that that was happening. They knew because they were told. But, you know, okay.
Yeah.
We'll take care of that when we get out.
Yeah, right. We'll get there, you know. And what they did is they got the trucks on the runway. The minute the wheel busted into flame. I mean, it just, that was it.
Yeah.
And she came to a stop and they just went in and they foamed it down and that was the end of it.
74.
This is all your aft tires are blowing and they're both burning, but not very badly. You've got 3 fire trucks with you.
Not another flying magazine. The news agents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
And how many test flights were there, Joe?
I don't even have the statistics right here.
She didn't fly that much,
no, she
did she?
Fly
there were the
that
first
much.
two test aircraft.
Right, the second aircraft didn't have that many flights. I would have to look that up for you.
Okay, okay. And we lost the second aircraft.
And we lost the second aircraft. So there's only the one that remains.
And there's one
there
left.
Were
okay, I'm going
to
come.
There were enough to make history.
You know, the other thing, we were discussing the cockpit. And I think the clamshell should be discussed if we got a couple of minutes. Yeah. The clamshells, again, were an innovation. This was something that was never done before. And they thought it was going to be like this great thing where, God forbid, an aircraft goes south. You got a problem. Okay, you're going to encapsulate. You're going to punch out. And this is going to save the pilot from things that would happen to somebody that would normally punch out. Okay, you probably have pilots out there that know exactly what I'm talking about.
And they also had some way of controlling the aircraft minimally from within that clamshell.
A little bit, not much.
Yeah.
But once these clamshells closed and they encapsulated and they blew out, which could be through the top, okay, the pilot was supposed to be in his little cocoon and he would be a lot safer than having to go out with the parachute and going through the crushed vertebrae in the back because it was so violent. You know, anyone that's punched out of an airplane can tell you how violent it is. In the accident, when the quote test of it actually happened, Carl Crosser was in the right seat. He was knocked unconscious or was killed. We really don't know. Okay. And Al White was trying to, before he punched out, he was trying to get him to encapsulate, trying to, you know, Carl, wake up, you know. It wasn't happening. And when the captain said, eject, 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 that's it, brother. You go, you're on your own. That's the law of the cockpit. That's the training. That's the way it's done. So there was always this big conjecture of, you know, well, Al White left him there. No, Al White did not leave him there. He got his arm stuck. Can you imagine when this clamshell came down with the power that it had? I don't know how many PSI were in there, but it was almost hermetically sealed. It came down on his elbow and his arm, just crushed the living hell out of it. Okay? When he ejected, there was supposed to be a bladder underneath that clamshell that would soften the blow when they landed via the parachute. Okay? That bladder never expanded. So when he came down, them had internal injuries. They didn't think he was going to live for 3 months. That's how bad he was. And that was one of the things that, you know, really frightened the hell out of everybody after this accident. You know, the accident itself was a lot, but then once you see it actually happen in working form, you know, like, this is the reason why we made things, you know, people really thought about it then and said, is this such a good idea?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So it's a point that should be brought out, especially since we're talking about her flying. I mean, in the early days, you know, they had a lot of problems. There was, you know, she was a rudder airplane. And I think most people out there know what I mean. She had a lot of yaw. That's one of the reasons they had the canards up there, because without those ailerons, she was just slip sliding away. You know, I mean, she was just going. So that was one of the thing was that the second bird actually had a -5 dihedral built into the wing that the first aircraft didn't have to try and help her with that huge slip slide issue. And it did help it tame it a little bit. So, you know, the autopilot system that the third airplane was supposed to get, would have made the work in the cockpit less intensive. Exactly what Joe said. These guys had to work. This was no pee up there. They had to work. So they were sweating it hard when they came out of there.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about something positive, Joe. And this is where I come back to before the show, we were talking about memories in your head. You got to see the last flight, didn't you?
Oh, yes, it was. It was something.
Tell us about that.
I was working at, I mentioned before, the Air Force Motion Picture Depository, and we, along the years that this program was going, were seeing regular films of this project, the assembly of the airplane, and we followed it through. When we found out that it was going to land at Wright-Patterson, there were three of us that worked together there that asked permission to take a couple of hours off and go watch the airplane land. It was Bill, John, and I got into John's car, drove over to the other side of the base, found a place to park the car in a little pocket park beside a little over a mile from the main runway, but that's close at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Yeah.
And we waited for the airplane to arrive. And it did eventually. It was flying high, somewhere around 8,000 to 10,000 feet, in a formation very much like they were in a certain test regime, an F-104 and a B-58. They flew over. They went down and flew over Cincinnati. They came back and flew over Columbus. And then the third time, she made a low pass. And in the low pass, she had the 104 and the B-58 at some distance, but still flying beside her. And here comes the black smoke out of those engines. She pitches way up. And it looked like she was standing on her tail, but it was only a 9-degree pitch up. And she flew about, 50 to 100 feet off of the runway, over the runway at a 12,000-foot runway there at Wright-Pat, and then climbed on out. And some minutes later, she came back, but lower. And the smoke was blacker, the pitch seemed a little bit higher, and the airplane finally touched down. And immediately, three parachutes came out to help her slow down a little bit. The nose came down, and then the sensation of this enormous airplane rolling to the end of the runway. They were doing a test of the braking system even then. When they flew from out west to Wright-Patterson, they were still doing tests. And finally, she rolled to a stop at the end of the runway. And I'll go back and talk about this whole thing a little bit different way. But her engines were getting ready. I don't think we waited until they wound the engines down, because we were there for, maybe an hour or so, and we had to get back to work. But here was this enormous white bird sitting at the end of the runway, and you knew that airplane was never going to fly again. Now, when you first see this thing above you, it is not like an airplane. It is like a creature. I think the cobra idea is close. Up there, it seemed like some kind of ancient dinosaur streamlined. And you become breathless when you see it for the first time in flight. It doesn't seem possible something like that can fly. And when she came down closer and she pitched up, you got to see this plan form from underneath. And she really seemed to be balancing on that smoky tail as she went down the runway.
And what did she sound like, Joe?
There was a roar, but it was not a loud roar from where we were. It was a roar, something that you might expect from maybe six jet engines, but as she touched down and nose came down, she began to slow, and all that really kind of went away. But yeah, once she went down the runway on that pass, you could detect that there was a lot of power behind the airplane, because she had all the six engines burning just to keep her balanced in that high pitch attitude, and then to climb out. But it was not deafening. What we saw on the base, though, was it seemed to sparkle down there in the part of the base, because I described it as a berserk Christmas trees of a whole bunch of police and fire vehicles, plus there was a Cayman helicopter flying with a retardant bell down below, following the airplane down the runway. And I had never in my life seen any emergency lights on Wright-Patterson. It was amazing. It was just amazing. And the bad thing about that, I guess, is here we were, three guys from a motion picture operation. None of us had a camera.
Well, there are some shots of it out there, so we'll see if we can put some links into that. But just before we wrap up, Jeanette, we've talked about the two aircraft. We lost one. There's one left, but there was talk of the third model still being around, or parts of it being around.
Oh yeah, the third Valkyrie 20208. You know, she was canceled February 18th, 1964, which is really a stupid move on the part of everyone involved. The keel had already been laid. The parts were made. Production was on schedule. It was just a waste of money. So here we are. Programs, you know, down. Why? You know, it was crazy. So anyway, she had a lot of things that were going to be built into her. You know, IBM already had a bomb nav system ready for her. The Air Force was doing everything to save the program. They were even trying to make her into a reconnaissance strike bomber, which was really a very interesting thing, because she was being looked at to launch the X-15. She was looking for supersonic aerial refueling, which no one has really done anything with yet. You know, so there were a lot of things that could have happened with this airplane. So basically, here it comes. The guys are told, the guys at NAA are told, you know, hey, you know, we go to work. And they go in and they're told, everybody, drop your stuff and go home. They all looked around like, why? Program's over. Go home. We'll tell you when to come back. They waited 1, 2, 3 weeks. Finally, they got a call to come back and pick up their tools and their personal things. Okay. The guys, when they got in the hangar, everything was cleaned out. And I mean all. It wasn't a scrap. Okay. So everybody's looking around like, what happened here? Nothing. Program's over. Get your stuff and get out. Okay. End. So, okay. That was the end of it. They really didn't have anything to say. So now we have a few years, way few years after that, there was a guard that worked at Plant 3 at Palmdale, where they were building. And he thought he had found something in the garbage. And what it looked like, maybe it was part of the third Valkyrie. But it actually, he took it to a salvager who knew a lot about the stuff. The Air Force was using the salvager to get rid of their stuff. And they said, you know, he says, is this part of it? He says, nah. He says, this is part of a B-2 mock-up. He says, I just dumped this stuff. He said, oh, okay. He says, but however, about 4 or 5 years ago, he said, I took out about 20, he said something like 20 or 30,000 pounds of the third Valkyrie that they had destroyed. Okay, that he melted down. Ugh. So, okay, so we figured end of that, right? All right. Meanwhile, Falk, who was the point man for the accident, he was also the point man for General Electric. He was a big shot in the program. He called me up one day and he said, Jeanette, since you're writing this book, he said, could you do me a favor? And I said, sure, what? He says, I got 11 YJ-93 engines that we can't find. I said, what do you mean you can't find them? He says, I'll give you the serial numbers. Gave me all the serial numbers. He says, we don't know where they are. He says, and the Air Force says that they don't have them. So I did my sleuthing trick, and I worked on that for about 4 months. I mean, diligently going through Tinker Air Force Base where they store everything. You name it, all the way down to California to see what happened to these 11 engines. I never found out. Went back to Eric and said, I'm sorry, man. Somebody's got your engines. They were not scrapped out, however. They were not scrapped out because we would have known because there was gold on those engines. Okay. Remember when I said there was gold on them? So they weren't scrapped out. Another friend of mine who's also an author said, what the hell? I'm going to give it a shot. He went in. He tried to find nothing. Okay. So we both sat here and said, well, you know. And then one day we see a copy of Aviation Week magazine. There's a thing on there that says Black Star. And I called Joe up. I said, did you get your copy? He said, yeah. He said, what the hell is this about? I said, I don't know, you know. But we're mentioned. Look, so we go in and we're reading the article. And somebody said that they had seen an aircraft with a platform like the XB-70 with the SR-71. In essence, she had in that long section of her neck, it was sort of like a chine instead of just being a round fuselage. So that kind of gave it the SR-1 XB-70, you know, jammed together look. And this person claimed that they had seen this airplane. And there was another woman who also claimed she had seen this strange platform during the day, which we found strange because anything, I mean, I've dealt hugely with Area 51, okay? I have a background with these guys and I know a lot about what goes on there that I don't talk about.
Oh, yes.
Okay?
We both do.
He's been with them. I know them. And you know, so I know a lot about what goes on in Area 51. And I said one day, I said, gee, you know, whatever happened? They said, well, you know, I'm not going to talk about it. You know that. I said, yeah, I know that. But I never felt that the XB-70 died. I always felt that there was a piece of her around somewhere. She's flying somewhere. Now, was she Black Star? Is she SR-3? There are some other nomenclature that are going around. It's possible. It's very possible. I think if anything, she might have been not necessarily the pieces of 20208, but the concept of 20208 may have been used on another form of aircraft. And they had probably tested with it, whatever they did with it. And, you know, this is where the Black Star theory came up from. So
that's where the engines went too.
That's where we're thinking. Maybe they used the engines for that reason, you know, because we never found them. So, it's an interesting story about Black Star. I was a little shocked when I saw it myself.
We're gonna come back to you, Jeanette, because there's some other stories we do want to talk to you about, and I also would love to get Joe back to talk about his role as curator. But we're running now out of time. Mm-hmm. Can I tell
you one more thing?
Fire away.
Okay. For anybody's information, I was the curator there, and I retired 21 years ago, but I still love the place, as Jeanette does. Come and see her.
Come and see her.
What we have there. There are four gigantic buildings. She is in the number fourth new building, and see for yourself. It is.
Even if you do it on the virtual tour, right? Even if you, if you're in England and you can't go, or wherever you are, you can't go. Go on the virtual tour.
Wow.
And see it.
Okay, I'll put a link to
magnificent.
That. Magnificent. That was the question I was going to ask. Where can we see the last
the only
example?
One, you know?
Yeah,
she's the only one.
Yeah, and
so you're there.
She's at the National Museum of the United States Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Wright Field section, and it's open to the public.
And it's free.
Right.
All 3 days a year, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's.
That's
here
it.
In the United States.
Well, certainly on my bucket list, and hopefully we'll encourage a few to go as a result of this program as well. But more importantly, we hope we've drummed up some interest for people to go and look at at least two of your books on the Valkyrie. Of course, the latest one is the XB-70 Valkyrie, The Return to Valhalla. You can get that on the usual sources, Amazon and that sort of
usual
place.
Usual sources, Amazon, right, exactly.
Right.
It's not an ebook yet. Will be an ebook, but probably, I think it's still got a couple of months to go yet, Joe.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, a couple of months to go yet, but it will be an ebook at some point, probably within 2 months, 2-3 months.
Well, we've just had a discussion with some people about ebooks, and there's some great photos in here, so I know people want the hard copies too. So go over to Amazon, use the link on our website. Jeanette, Joe, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure learning about an aircraft that I didn't know a great deal about. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for allowing us
to bring her to you, because since she is the only one in the world, there's no one else. She's our girl. We love her. We just adore this aircraft and everything that went into her. And she is something magnificent in aviation history. You really need to just maybe just not to buy a book from us or anybody. I mean, any XB-70 book, just sit down and just think about her and what she gave to aviation. That's really what her story is. Because when you look at her, you know, you have to think of the one. The B-1 came out of her. So she really gave a lot.
Well, on that note, Jeanette, I couldn't have put it more passionately myself. Thank you very much, Joe. Thank you very much, Jeanette.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
It was great fun.
Yes, it was.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extend it.
This is XTP Media.